got last 10 sessions.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Senator Larson is going to go first. He has a commitment down in the Tax Committee.
Constitution provision to give him the raise. We can never cut him again.
Yeah. Watson doesn't think that's true. In this case.
So, members, while Senator Larson is situating himself, I think what I'd like to do is see if we can get through numbers 1, 2, and 3. And then when we're getting close to 5, if we don't leave the room, the caucus members can't come in here, so we'll make a decision. We'll make a decision on let's see how far we get on the agenda, and we can make a decision.
We can come in and watch.
Senator Larson, Senate File 181.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I come to you today with Senate File 181, which actually was brought to me by a House member, Representative Paul Thiessen, who he and I share a legislative district. And this bill simply deletes the inability for someone to file a claim in Minnesota if they are, in fact, harmed in a defamation case by an action from outside the state of Minnesota. And in 1978, the statute was restricted in this area to not allow such a claim to go forward. And in fact, and I don't have the case in front of me, but a case that was tried actually by Representative Thiessen, the outcome of that was the court, one of the court findings was that the legislature really ought to revisit this discussion about whether or not someone ought to be able to file a claim. And if, in fact, for example, you are or a person is harmed in Minnesota by action of somebody in terms of defamation that is not in Minnesota, the person in Minnesota has no recourse to file a claim. And it seems to me that that is a reasonable ability under the law to be able to file that claim. I appreciate the opportunity to present this before you today, members, and this is the first time, I think, that I've been before the Judiciary Committee. I'm told that that's territory that's not recommended for non-lawyer members of the legislature, but here I am. So, thank you, members.
It's an honor.
Indeed, it is an honor to come before this committee.
It certainly is.
And it is an honor to have you in this committee.
Thank you.
Oh, let's get at it.
You never said that to this guy.
You're a member of this honorable committee, Senator Limmer. Any questions, Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Larson, wouldn't there be federal court jurisdiction if there were diversity between citizens?
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ortman, I'm not sure that I have the answer to that question, the answer must be no. There must not be, because in the case that I described earlier, again, I don't have that file with me, but clearly the court found, I think, that in fact someone ought to be able to bring this action, and given that they were not, thought that Minnesota should revisit this issue. And I don't know if counsel can help us with that or not.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What we're talking about is a defendant outside of Minnesota, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to try and hold them accountable in state court. But there's no reason I can think of why they wouldn't be subject to a federal lawsuit if there were diversity jurisdiction, meaning it's a citizen of Minnesota versus a citizen of another state with the proper jurisdictional amount over $75,000 in claims and damages could file that lawsuit in federal court. Now, I could see perhaps there was no cause of action allowed in state court, but that doesn't mean that there is no place to, no proper courtroom for filing that lawsuit. It could be there. Now, if the jurisdictional amount were not met, and we were talking about under the $75,000 in damages, then this person might be without a remedy because they can't file in state court. But if they, but there is, I believe, federal court jurisdiction under those circumstances. One of the, I thought the agenda said that Lloyd Grooms was going to be here. Is he here to help you with this bill? He might be able to answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Ortman. My understanding is Mr. Grooms is not able to be here at this time. And Mr. Grooms, in my discussions with him, who has represents the State Bar Association, had expressed a willingness to provide clarification if necessary, but the State Bar has not taken a position on the bill, either for or against the bill.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, my concern is that you've got an out-of-state defendant without sufficient contacts in Minnesota, perhaps even to be served here, so that they can come and be defendant properly in a state court. And I think some, it'd be nice to know why the State Bar Association is supporting this. The agenda says Winthrop and Weinstein. They're not supporting it.
They haven't taken a position.
Then I think that I have reservations about it because I think that there is a jurisdiction. It's the federal court, just not for that lower damages amount.
Senator Betzel.
I've been reading. This is the long-arm statute that allows us to find jurisdiction. And the current law on page 1, lines 13, I guess, through 17, establishes basically what it would take to find jurisdiction in Minnesota. However, it has some exceptions. We won't have exceptions if Minnesota does not have a substantial interest in providing the form. Or if the burden on the defendant brought in under the state's jurisdiction violates fairness and substantial justice. Those are kind of broad. But then it lists a specific cause of action of defamation and privacy, and I don't know what the history of this statutory section is, but we do provide a forum if somebody from outside the state causes on line 15 any act in Minnesota causing injury or property damage. For some reason, the legislature decided that privacy or defamation would not be an injury. And it just seems a little odd because we have basically provided a forum with three exceptions, two which are quite broad and, you know, can be argued, but then there's a specific cause of action, and it's just a little odd to see that there. So I'm not quite sure. It reads strangely, and I can see what the argument, you know, why the bill is before us. I just don't know why the legislature chose to structure it that way.
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel. My understanding, the legislation that created this part of the statute was passed in 1978. And apparently at that time there was some concern about if in fact someone perhaps was living in another state and did something as simple as sent a letter, but that was defaming somebody, that in fact they could be a claim could be filed against them in state court. And so I think that was the rationale apparently in 78. Not having been there, that's just what I understand to be the short version of how that came to be. But as we have the ability with electronic media and whatever, it seems to me that if someone is in fact harmed in a case of defamation, and, you know, Senator Ortman, you may be raising another interesting part of this, that there are thresholds that we have to be sensitive to, that in fact someone may not be able to pursue this in the federal court under current circumstances, that it'd be reasonable that someone have the ability to make a claim in the state if they've been harmed.
Senator Ortman.
I'm sure you can always sue someone where the defendant resides. There's no reason why, if somebody writes something on a blog in California, that we should be able to sue that person in Minnesota necessarily. And that's, I think, we're talking about speech and we're talking about privacy. And I see that Mr. Grooms is here. Maybe he can talk about this bill a little and maybe he can help clarify the intention behind it, because I'm concerned Mr. Grooms, we were just talking about whether there's federal court jurisdiction, if it meets the threshold in the diversity test, and if there's some other reason why you think that we need this in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Lloyd, with Winthrop Vermont. Relative to your question, I think relative to the threshold question, you could still, if you're below the threshold, of course, then you won't make yourself into federal court. And even as a defamation claim, you're still going to have to show some damages. So the question asked, I think your question of someone posted something on a blog, the question still is there a damage beyond from the defamation on a blog? You simply could say, someone posted something on a blog, I'm offended, therefore I want to go into court. But at least this, under a different circumstance, does allow you at least to bring that claim into state court.
Well,
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grooms, except for defamation per se, you don't need damages either. So if you write something in a blog or you have a conversation outside of Minnesota or you give a letter to somebody outside the state of Minnesota, but it alleges a crime or something in your business, trade, or profession, things like that, you don't need any damages. You can just start suing for general damages because you live here. Is that what you're intending to try to allow be brought in Minnesota?
Mr. Grooms.
Madam Chair of the committee, I apologize, I was conferring with the author on the bill. I think even in say, though, you still have to actually prove the
general damages.
General damages. So I think you're still in the same circumstance as opposed to simply bill or bare allegation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Could you give us a concrete example or two that has generated this bill? I mean, what types of situations occurring outside of Minnesota are you not able to bring into Minnesota that you would like to now?
Well, under Madam Chair, members of the committee, right now there is a blanket exclusion for defamation. Base, and I think what the courts have said is you can't bring that defamation claim.
So Madam Chair, so you don't really have any particular types of scenarios. You just want it generally opened up altogether.
Madam Chair, members
Mr. Grooms.
I think relative to the circumstance, some of the cases that we've seen have usually fallen within, say, deceptive trade practices. Was there a Northwest case several years ago, circumstance where the court in fact said, no, under the face of the statute, the terms of the statute, you cannot bring this claim. I don't think it's in terms of trying to provide specific limitations as to only limited circumstance. What we did is take the statute as written and simply eliminate that exclusion.
Any further discussions or input from the members? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, you did make a reference to a court case that represents case in hand. Do you have any facts or the background, what happened in that one that can help put this in context? What was he trying to do where the judge said the statute doesn't allow it?
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Betzel. I'm going to ask Mr. Grooms, I think, who has a little bit more knowledge of the specific case that we're talking about.
Mr. Grooms?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel. The case, and I apologize, in terms of the case involving Northwest Airlines and a claim made against the airline, but I apologize. I can't tell you the facts off the top of my head. I don't have the case with me today, but I could.
Okay.
All right. Members, if there's no further discussion, Senate File 181. Senator Ortman.
I'm not convinced of the need for this. I'd sure like to talk to Representative Thiessen if he had something else to add to this conversation, but I can't see any need to do it, and I'm concerned that if we do it, you know, there are reasons why we have the long-arm jurisdiction set up the way we do, and we don't ordinarily allow people to sue defendants from other states in Minnesota unless they have sufficient contacts with the state of Minnesota. And I haven't heard that there are any contacts other than someone on a blog in California might make a statement about somebody in Minnesota, and that person might perceive harm in Minnesota, and all of a sudden we've got a lawsuit in state court against some California defendant for nominal damages. And I'm not sure that we have an interest in expanding the courts to do that kind of work.
Senator Larson.
Well, Madam Chair, certainly I'd be happy to, as the process plays forward, I don't know if you plan to lay this over for a possible discussion to be included in either an omnibus policy bill, or I don't know what your intentions are as it relates to that.
The Senate Judiciary Committee does not have omnibus policy bills.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the
Mr. Grooms.
More than happy to come back at a later time. I've had a chance to answer Senator Ortman, Senator Betzel's questions. I don't want them to be uncomfortable with the application of the bill.
Senator Larson, we'll lay the bill over until the questions have been answered, and perhaps Mr. Grooms, you'll work with Senator Ortman on getting her information and her questions.
Senator Betzel, Madam Chair.
And Senator Betzel.
Sounds fair, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Larson.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
The member did remind us we will have one omnibus bill, and that's the data practices bill. So there is an omnibus bill, but not a civil law omnibus bill.
Madam Chair.
That's correct.
Is there
Senator
a need
Ortman.
For a motion and a vote on that? Or?
It's in the committee. We'll just lay it over. Why, Senator Ortman, did you want to vote no on laying it over? Right?
No.
I mean, it's in the committee. Senator Scheid, let's take Senator Higgins is not here, and we have to review a small part of a bill where Senator Scheid is a co-author of. So Senator Scheid has graciously agreed to present that bill to us. So let's say Senate File 809, first engrossment first. And Senator Scheid, I understand that there's an amendment.
Madam Chair, yes, this bill has to do with predatory lending. The Commerce Committee put in quite a lengthy hearing, I think about 5 hours worth, one evening a week or two ago. And Senator Higgins had two bills. I think you have another one here in the committee of hers, and I'm sure when she's back, she'll be able to present that. I think I also have one, but this one we'd like to see get moving, Senate File 809. And there has been considerable work put into this by the Attorney General's task force that the Attorney General Swanson put together before session started, I believe, to look into the subject of predatory lending. And this bill reflects recommendations from that task force. However, they've been modified from the original bill introduction, but I think that they still accomplish good things to do something meaningful about predatory lending that is leading to a number of subprime loans being made inappropriately to people who clearly did not have the ability to repay them. And we know, I think members are quite aware of the foreclosure issue and the rising numbers of foreclosures that we're seeing right now across the country, actually. But it's particularly alarming in Minnesota when we have such high home ownership, and that's a value that's been long held here. So we are concerned. And Senator Higgins has this bill. I believe that what you're primarily concerned about here is on page 5 of the first engrossment. Am I correct?
Senator Scheid, members, what's in this jurisdiction is the language on page 5 from lines 5-7 to 5-20, and in particular, we were concerned about, I believe, a rebuttable presumption that was in this language. Now, here is what's going to happen. The A5 amendment,
Madam Chair. The A5 amendment will remove that language. And actually, you'd start on line 6 by putting in a semicolon instead of that period at the end of the line, and go from 24 down to the end of line 6, semicolon, to line 5.21, and just continue.
And so, members, what the A5 amendment will do is it will remove the language that brought the bill to the committee, and once the A5 amendment is adopted, the bill, basically, there's nothing else in the bill that is within the committee's jurisdiction, and we can send it on its way. So, Senator Shah, do you want to move the A5 amendment?
Madam Chair, I do.
Any objections from the members on the A5 amendment?
Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
What is the amendment again? Taking out 24?
The A5 amendment, Senator Neville, takes out the language on page 5, starting at line 5.7 through line 5.20.
Okay. So we're keeping the churning in, but the presumption is out.
Yes. Any further questions on the amendment? See none. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Shah.
Madam Chair, do we have another amendment?
Is there another amendment to
that Ms. Pontius might
another
have
member?
Had? Or?
I don't have another amendment. Apparently, there was discussions of another issue or another amendment, but it's a commerce issue. And we didn't feel that it was proper in this committee to be.
And Madam Chair, yes. And when we left committee that night, our committee did meet till 11 that evening. And when we left, we knew that we would be further amending the bill. We completed the work. The committee voted. We knew what had to be done. I believe Senator Higgins will probably offer that on the floor. The members of the Commerce Committee know and understood that there was still some refinement to be done. And so I think this bill is ready to go, Madam Chair. And I move that Senate File 809, as amended, be recommended to pass. And I think that it is ready to go to the floor.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemire.
Madam Chair, there's references to fiduciary responsibilities. Would that be a judiciary reference that we have to
Madam Chair.
Concern ourselves with?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, that's one of the areas, and perhaps I should go through those areas. We have considerable discussion about fiduciary, some nervousness about that on the part of the brokers, the loan officers. And I believe that a compromise has been struck, and it would apply the law of agency as opposed to fiduciary. Agency is where you accustomed to in real estate. And that is one of the accommodations. And Mr. Elwood can perhaps tell you what the other things are because my mind's gone blank.
Senator Lemire, do you want to fully develop your thoughts?
Well, Madam Chair, when a real estate agent works for a client, it's a fiduciary responsibility. And many of the responsibilities, as I may remember, involves informing a client, keeping accounting for a client, certainly not disclosing anything beyond the instruction of the client. Have to follow directions from the client as whatever is legally requested. I may be missing one more element of fiduciary responsibility. Now, banking is a little different because it's got a variety of product line. You ask for commitment on behalf of the individual seeking out the mortgage, and yet it's trying to pinpoint something in a vastly changing sea. And sometimes that responsibility gets difficult to define, especially regarding accounting options when it comes to the full merit of a mortgage that's being offered to a customer. And so I saw the fiduciary responsibilities as new responsibilities, and I'm just wondering if maybe we could get a little more definition of how a fiduciary relationship might be made sure that happens. And is it a limited responsibility or is it not?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, that is one of the things that I believe has been agreed to be amended, to apply agency rather than fiduciary.
In a new amendment?
Well, I thought it was going to be here, so I apologize.
I see.
And that's my mistake because I didn't check, so I just had understood.
Selwood, do you have any responses to Senator Limmer's concerns?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Limmer, the very issues that you're talking about have been addressed in an amendment that has been made in the House. And, in fact, tomorrow the bill will be heard on the House floor with the new
body.
Language.
The other body.
The other body. I misspoke. I apologize. And I'm duly chastised and will never do it again.
Just but you mean it, Mr. Elwood.
I do mean that. I trust me. But I Senator Limmer, I think that the very issues that you're talking about have been addressed in the agreement with the industry that is reflected in this new language that I just referred to. In terms of the duties to disclose material facts, it's a very similar standard, but it does not. The fiduciary duty per se is no longer in play.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, maybe just for my own education, what statute exists that defines fiduciary duty?
I don't know.
I guess I'm not sure which one that is.
Ms. Pondius.
Yes, Madam Chair, I think it's more common law. And, I mean, there's a number of statutes that have fiduciary duties and create them, and then sometimes actually spell them out a little bit more, but there's a large body of common law as well.
The reason I ask is because the way it's written now, it says imposed on fiduciaries by statute or common law. And, you know, there are fiduciary duties for things like powers of attorney, for conservators. And I wasn't sure which one would be applicable to a general fiduciary duty. So, but that's coming out anyway, right? Okay. So what standard, if we replace that with shall be a duty of agency, so who will they be the agent of? The mortgage company that they're the broker for? Or the agent of the borrower? Who do they have? I'm not sure. Maybe can you explain how the agency theory works?
Madam Chair,
Selwood.
Senator Neville, the new language requires the broker to act in the best interest of the borrower. But it does not. There's specific language that would not require, for example, the broker to access a product to which he or she doesn't utilize in the normal course of business. So, for example, if they dealt with five lenders and the products that those five lenders offered, but some lender in California offered a lower price, the statutory language would say that the broker would not have to look at every possible product in every possible state.
I didn't understand that. I don't know.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, there's a general agency duty to act in the best interest of the borrower. It's an agency relationship, and the standards include acting in the best interest of the borrower, disclosing all material facts, similar to the duty obedience, the typical agency types of duties, acting with reasonable care, accounting to the borrower, those kinds of things. But there is a limitation and a protection in essence, so that the best interest doesn't mean that if you're dealing with a certain sphere or scope of lenders in accessing products, and there may be a different product out there, and you didn't offer that product, that's not a breach of the duty. That's what I was trying to get at. And this is language that the brokers believe is satisfactory. This is an agreement between the Attorney General's office and the Groves. All right.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Scheid. So just in a nutshell, when we talked about this in Commerce, what I liked about the fiduciary duty was that it imposed an obligation to act in the borrower's interest as opposed to in the lender's interest. And it sounds like what you're saying is we're still imposing that duty, but not quite as severely as we were, or not quite to the degree that we were, because I assume there just are different elements between what's required of a fiduciary as opposed to the agency relationship, but I don't know as much about the agency standard as I do about the fiduciary standard.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson. I think essentially what you're saying is correct. It's a lower standard, but it still would say you must act in the borrower's best interest and the utmost good faith toward borrowers, shall not compromise their right or interest in favor of another's, including of the broker, including in the interest of the broker, shall, and there are other requirements that are to be put into this amendment when we see it again. But this was something, as you recall, in Commerce, there was considerable discussion about it because nobody could quite put their finger on exactly what we meant by fiduciary. For example, if you walk into a bank where your checking account or savings account are located, they do not have a fiduciary duty on those accounts. But a trust account, or I think it's an IRA, I believe they do have a fiduciary duty. But just for your savings account, no.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, I think the reason for that is if you're just depositing money, they're not giving you advice. But in a situation where you're dealing with a mortgage broker, they're advising you, and whether they're going to advise you in your interests or advise you in their interests, that was, you know, the concern, and I think that was the reason the fiduciary was put in there to begin with. But sounds like an agreement's been reached that makes everyone more comfortable with this.
And Madam Chair, that's correct, and it does, I think, protect the borrower's interest in the way you're suggesting it should.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I think some of the confusion that we see is I had mentioned that as a real estate agent, I represent a client, and I have to represent them based on the instructions that they give me. That's where a fiduciary responsibility is probably the anytime you're an agent creating a representation for a client. And the difficulty that the mortgage industry, I think, has is that the mortgage industry has a set range of products. They have loan officers that work in order to gather loan applicants that are worthy of a loan, and the customer out there comes to the mortgage company seeking the loan. It isn't quite the same relationship that you have with a loan officer working on behalf of his client, or if it's a mortgage broker, they have a field of products that they represent to a customer. It blurs the line a little bit when the customer comes in and then they start working together as to picking the right product that best fits the needs of the customer. And it's not a full representation on behalf of the client, the customer. And even in existing law, I think there's a reference here that we put in on page 7, existing law, that at one time or another on page 7, line 9, the originator, and this is to be put on every loan application, lines 9 on page 7, in big capital 14-point boldface print, the originator is not acting as your agent in connection with obtaining a residential or mortgage loan. While we seek to assist you in meeting your financial needs, we cannot guarantee the lowest or best loans available on the market. So this this relationship, it appears, and I kind of remember this, we've gone over this language years before in trying to define what that agent, what that loan originator is and what's his responsibility to the consumer.
Senator Scheid, you're on this committee, and you're the chair of the Commerce Committee.
And Madam Chair, we talked about that with Senator Olson and my both being on this committee and on Commerce Committee, that we would be able to share with the rest of this committee what the sense of the Commerce Committee was that evening. And it looks like Ms. Pontius has...
Ms. Pontius had the proposed amendment that yes. Would have been drafted in front of us. Since we're already engaging in that conversation, I think that there is a curiosity as well as a desire on the part of the committee members to look at this amendment.
And, Madam Chair, I think it's appropriate. I think a discussion of fiduciary and agency is appropriate in the Judiciary Committee, certainly, and I think we thought that in the Commerce Committee. So
members, passed out before you, not necessarily in the amendment form, but I think that we will view it as an amendment if it is the desire of this committee to engage in this discussion and to look at this amendment. I think that the only other place where this amendment will be put on will be on the Senate floor. And if Senator Scheid is and Senator Olson are all right with us having this debate here to help the bill along, then since we're there already, let's take a look at the amendment. Do you want to walk us through the amendment, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, yes. And is it Hawkins?
Yeah.
Ms. Amber Hawkins is here to talk about it because she has been working with the task force and with the industry and everybody who's interested in this to come up with this language.
So Ms.
this
Hawkins.
Reflects what Senator Higgins, I believe, has asked that be done as well.
And Ms. Hawkins, this is the compromise language on this section that's being put forth?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Everything in this proposed amendment has been part of a global compromise that we've reached regarding this bill.
Please walk the committee through the amendment.
All right. The first item, lines 1.8 through 2.3, are deleting some definitions. In an earlier version of the bill, we had tied items to whether a loan was a prime or subprime loan. So what we had, what the bill had done was pull the definition of investment grade from another spot in existing law and then built upon that definition to...
Ms. Hawkins,
yes.
Could you identify the organization you work with for the record?
I'm sorry. I work with Legal Aid.
Thank you.
Okay, so the first item is just deleting a couple of definitions that are no longer relevant in the form the bill is in now. The definition of investment grade was put back into existing law where it existed before this bill, and we left one definition in there of a fully indexed rate, which will it'll become clear why that's in there in a moment. The next item is just renumbering that remaining definition. Lines 4.1 through 4.7.
Can I see? No, of course.
Sorry. Thank you. That's just restoring existing law on the definition of investment grade. Lines 4.24 to 4.34. This is where we addressed the standard that lenders be required to verify a borrower's ability to pay for a loan. The previous, some of you may recall in the Commerce Committee, there was a concern expressed about the requirement that a lender be required to verify a borrower's ability to pay through income tax returns and other similarly reliable documents. What we've done to that definition in response to concerns that were raised by people in the industry is to the requirement is still that a lender must verify a borrower's income. However, if a lender is offering a program perhaps for certain communities that have been historically denied access to credit, who may have alternative forms of credit or alternative ways to demonstrate that they can pay for a loan other than just their income, Part of what we added was the second clause, nothing in this section shall be construed to limit a mortgage originator's or exempt person's ability to rely on criteria other than the borrower's income and financial resources. What that means essentially is that if the lender wants to rely on other criteria, they can do that. They just have to document what that criteria is. The next section, basically, sure. From this point till the bottom of the amendment.
Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, I had a question regarding the added criteria to rely on in order to approve a loan. How would this affect what they call stated loans? Stated loans are when an applicant comes before a lender, and the lender has a program with an investor that instead of relying on the individual's income, they rely more solely on the fact that they have a tremendously good credit rating and has been established that way. And they do want, in most cases, they make sure that they do have a job. They are working, gainfully employed. But the income is not as important as the credit score. And the credit score over time has proven that regardless of what the person's real income is, they manage to make a payment and they have a tremendously good credit rating and they manage to make it work. And they can prove that in a credit score. Are we denying that applicant a loan in this case by this definition?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Lemmer, what we are doing is actually the second piece of that was added to address your very concern. This bill does change something, though. It does make it a requirement that lenders document a borrower's resources, income, and other financial resources. We met with lenders to discuss this, and they basically told us they can always document a dollar. They can verify something, but if they choose to make a loan, let's say the income that they can verify wouldn't a loan sustain these loan payments, but they still want to make the loan because of the borrower's excellent credit history or perhaps their business assets or other sorts of factors. That's why we added the second paragraph, which basically says if the verified income isn't sufficient, this does not prohibit the lender from making that loan based on other criteria, as long as they verify what those other criteria are.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
A few years ago, you couldn't get a loan unless you qualified under what they called mortgage ratios, meaning your principal, interest, tax, and insurance, and a mortgage insurance premium, maybe an association fee. That was your monthly payment. And that had to be under a specific percentage based on your gross income. Well, that worked fine for people that had W-2 income that was very stable. It was predictive. But in reality, not everyone has W-2 income. Even realtors don't have W-2 income. They have 1099 income. And for anyone that's self-employed, it's very difficult to get a loan under that old system. So this other concocted stated loan process created an avenue for people that were self-employed that were good credit risk that could get a loan. And that's why I'm raising this statement, because I don't know if everyone knows the history of this and why we're at the dilemma we're at. I can understand where some players in the mortgage industry haven't been so careful in analyzing their customers as they came out to seek a loan, and they just had a credit rating that was good enough. They packed them into huge loans.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I think that, Senator Lemmer, you will see that they would still be able to use other criteria. I had people visit with me who do stated loans, but who on their own motion verify whatever information it is that they're given, that they will, accept. So that's what we're asking here, that it be documented.
But it's not, Madam Chair, it's not going back to the old ratio-type loans. Oh. I just want to make sure that...
There's no ratio in here, Madam Chair.
Got it. Okay.
Very good.
And, Madam Chair, we get
down... Senator Shide.
Madam Chair, I think that we... do some things on 4 and 5, but I think the most important piece is the churning section, which we had already discussed.
Madam Chair, I think I can make it a little bit easier. All those next items to the bottom of the page, I've basically summarized in this last paragraph, that the churning section now looks like the underlined language only, without the presumption in it.
And then, Madam Chair, on the back, and I think I need to offer an amendment, a further amendment, I think, and I want to ask Ms. Pontius if I might, if at the bottom of page 6, taking us into almost the rest of page 7, I think we want to take out section 7 because it's, do we want to delete it as...
You still need it.
I'm sorry. I stand corrected. Sit corrected. And, Madam Chair, then if you see the language then on the back side of this, starting with Section 6, mortgage broker duties of agency, and that was the conversation we were having regarding that versus fiduciary.
Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 1 of your amendment, there's a reference to lines 4 in the middle of the page, lines 4.37 to 4.38, and those loose references. Are we including those in this amendment?
Senator Shide?
I think Ms. Hawkins can answer. I wasn't listening very well.
Okay. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, actually, starting in the middle of the page, those line references are all off. What you really want to do is on page 5, delete lines 1 to 6, and then insert the new clause 24 for churning. So just kind of ignore all those. Starting with the 4.37 to 4.38, those references are all off.
Got it.
Okay.
If we choose to adopt this amendment, we will give Senate Counsel the latitude to work with, you know, the stakeholders to make sure that the language gets inserted into the appropriate space.
Chair, thank you.
Any further discussions? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, under Section 6, this agency language, there are 5 stated criteria. Are those the only duties then, the only agency duties? Or are we intending it to be broader? I mean, as I read it, it just says, and shall comply. It doesn't say including but not limited to or anything else like that. But we're not trying to expand the agency relationship to have any duties other than those 5 things. Is that right?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, that is correct. This is a statutory duty.
All right.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're considering the mortgage broker duties of agency, by this document, are we putting the mortgage broker in a dual agency? You have to represent the customer in relation to the terms in this agency, but the mortgage broker is also acting as an agent to the investor that he's trying to accumulate customers for and make the loan. So is there any opportunity that we may be putting the mortgage broker into conflict with one another?
Go ahead. Okay. Senator Lummer, actually, on behalf of Legal Aid, I've litigated some of these cases against mortgage lenders. And if you ask mortgage lenders if the broker is their agent, they will emphatically tell you no. And so the mortgage broker typically, you know, has relationships with many lenders. And so they are not an agent of any lender. You know, they are, they are arguably an agent of their employer, but under our state law, the broker and their employer are the same entity because it's actually the employer who is licensed. So you've got, you know, the broker is one body, and their duty is to the borrower under this standard, and they do not have a duty to act in the best interest of the lender.
So, Madam Chair, the mortgage broker, and we keep changing terms here, mortgage broker, loan officer, and I'm probably guilty of that too for the purpose of this discussion, but the mortgage broker will have to compile and they work with an underwriter. They accumulate the data on the customer. They package that data. They pass it on to the underwriter for full approval on behalf of the investor. And the investor is the one who's offering the money to transact the house deal, let's say. Those requirements have to be met by the investor, and if they're not met adequately, the investor will not make the loan. And furthermore, they have to fit a set requirement so that that investor can have the opportunity to sell that property on a secondary market. They may want to hold it, season the property or the document for a while. Maybe interest rates in the big market goes down and they have a higher rate note, so they can sell it at a higher yield to someone. And that becomes a secondary market sale. So there are requirements by the mortgage originator that has to be met based on the instructions that they have with that investor, with that moneyed investor. So there is a relationship there. Now, is it agency or is it just a business relationship? Is it a distant partnership? And as one tries to match that requirement with the consumer, are we putting the mortgage originator in conflict with either or both? We've had this discussion in real estate sales for years of whether or not dual agency should be valid. In Minnesota, it is valid, but it's under very strict rules. And I'm just wondering if we're tiptoeing into this type of profession, the mortgage originator, and getting them trapped in a dual agency conflict.
Ms. Hawkins or Mr. Elwood, whoever would.
Is there anything in the mortgage?
Senator Olson, Senator Limmer, this, first of all, I want to make it clear that this applies only to brokers who are not employed by a lender. So, for example, if you are a loan officer with Wells Fargo, this does not apply to you. It's clear to everybody that your duty is to your employer. You're making Wells Fargo loans, for example. The relationship between the brokers and the various lenders whose products they sell is more like a relationship of a salesperson who is carrying five different lines of product. And so that relationship, you know, again, the brokers have agreed to this language. They are accepting of this standard, and we think that it's their duty to get the best loan that they have available to them for the borrower while meeting their underwriting criteria, but it would be the same as any other threshold criteria necessary to make a sale of any kind of product.
Is there anyone from the mortgage industry that could tell us that this is a could confirm that they agree with this language? Well, a lot of people are standing up, but no one's coming to the table.
I mean, I don't think so. Okay. I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. It's my understanding that we have agreed to this language.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Ms. Cook, is Mortgage Banker Association, do they represent mortgage brokers?
They do both. Madam Chair.
Senator Shides.
Madam Chair, they've merged. They've merged. I think it's the Mortgage Banking Association. They have merged. The brokers and mortgage bankers have merged. Mr. Martin represents those two entities. Am I right?
He's coming over.
Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, obviously you probably want to hear from the Mortgage Brokers Association themselves. I don't think they themselves are in the room, but I can represent that they have. In fact, we spent hours upon hours upon hours together working on this language, and I can assure you that this is language that they are completely accepting of. This is an agreement that we both feel was protective of the borrowers, but not overreaching to the industry, and it's something that they felt was good for the industry, and did not prevent them from offering products, did not stifle products. It seems to be the perfect balance.
Senator Scheid?
Madam, I had moved the A5 amendment. We hadn't adopted it, did we? So I would then like to move the author's amendment, which is the two-sided 8x11 sheet that Ms. Pontius prepared. I'd like to move that.
Senator Scheid, can we strike from the second amendment? We adopted the A5 amendment already.
We did.
No, we did not.
Yeah.
Senator Scheid moves the A5 amendments. Wait, Senator Scheid?
Do I move
The language in the A5 amendment overlaps with the author's amendment.
Yes, it does.
So if we just do just the author's amendment, that should take care of the A5 amendment.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And that also deletes the rebuttable presumption language. Senator Scheid moves the author's amendment to Senate File 809, first engrossment. Any member in the audience would like to speak either for or against this amendment or this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Although it says author's amendment, this is not the committee jurisdiction, and the author isn't here. So,
Senator Betzel, I appreciate that. I just wanted to give some detail to the amendment since we didn't have a bill number. All right. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted.
Then, Madam Chair, I'd like to thank the committee for their indulgence on this on behalf of Senator Higgins, and I'm going to move Senate File 809 as amended be recommended to pass.
On Senator Scheid's motion, is there any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion passes. And this
chair.
Yes, Senator Scheid.
And Ms. Pontius will straighten out that language about the churning so that I think when we adopted that, what says author's amendment, it makes it clear what we wanted to have happen.
And I know that Senator Scheid meant to incorporate into that Senate File 809, the first engrossment as amended, will be re-referred to the Senate floor.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator Scheid.
Thank you. Thank you. Then, Madam Chair, what did you decide to do?
Members, Senator Marty has members in the public who were here to testify on his bill. They have graciously agreed that they would postpone their bill. Senator Scheid has people here also from the public who would like to testify on behalf of her bill. What I'd like to do, with your indulgence, is that we have about 15 minutes before our caucus begins. I'd like to take testimony or at least hear about the mechanics of the bill from Senator Scheid. We will recess at 5 so that we can go to our various caucuses, and then we will reconvene at 6 o'clock. That will get them out of this room. And I'd like to finish Senator Scheid's bill tonight. And then Senator Betzel, your bill and Senator Marty's bill will be on the agenda tomorrow. And I do apologize to members of the public who are here on those two bills that we could not get to you. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, this is a revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. Our current law is titled the Darlene Luther Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. We obviously would like to maintain that title. It's brought forward by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws and also by LifeSource. And I will let Ms. Larson later explain who LifeSource is if you're not familiar. This is about increasing the number of lives we're able to save through organ transplantation. And I should mention that it deals only with organs donated from a deceased person. It's not about living donation. I believe that I'm correct in saying that. So, I mean, I've had legislation in the past having to do with living donors and donation, but this is not. And this, I think it harmonizes the law with current practice. It clarifies how individuals can document their wishes to donate along with who makes the gifts for a person who has died. And I have Honorable Jack Davies and former State Senator Jack Davies here. He is a Uniform Law Commissioner. Susan Ma Larson, who is the Director of Public Affairs for LifeSource, and then Ms. Jana Hosky, am I saying that right?
That's correct.
Whose son, Alan, gave the gift of life through his untimely death. So I think what we have, are you going to speak first?
Sure.
Susan?
Okay.
Senator Shai, do you have, this is the first time this bill is being heard in a committee. But from the Judiciary Committee, this bill will be going to the Health Policy Committee, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I don't think it has to.
You don't have to see it?
I don't think it has to. It may have to go to Finance. I mean, it got a fiscal note, so
okay.
I say may. I know it will have to.
Yes, there's a fiscal note. So from here, it will go to Finance. Now, do you have an author's amendment?
I do, and it's the A1.
And members, you have the A1 author's amendment in your packet. So why don't we adopt the A1 amendment, and then either Judge Davis or Ms. Larson can walk us through the bill. Senator Scheid moves the A1 amendment to put Senate File 883 in the shape that she would like it to be in. All those in favor, say aye.
Hold it.
I'd like to make an oral amendment to that author's amendment, if I can. Jack Davies, a member of the conference. On the Alliance Treaty of the Amendment, if you'd cross off person who discovered the body and insert first responder, and then cross off persons and put first responders. That's what was intended 2 years ago or a year ago when that language was added to existing law. We could not figure out what it meant when it just said person, and we just found out that it meant first responder.
Senator Scheid will incorporate that into the A1 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Now, Ms. Larson, are you walking us through? Are you going to walk us through, do the section-by-section walkthrough?
No, I guess I wasn't going to do a section-by-section walkthrough, but I could just highlight some of the key changes. I apologize, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Susan Ma Larson, and I'm the Director of Public Affairs for LifeSource.
Well, as you go through then, what's confusing is because we're sort of recodifying everything. Maybe perhaps you can point out to us what's in current law and what the new what new language is being proposed.
Okay. And I believe you've all received a copy of the side-by-side comparison. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
So that will be helpful. And basically, as you said, this is an act written by NCUSL. This act was first written in 68 and then revised and adopted in 87. So this just really continues that process. Some of the key changes that are important for Minnesota is that this act does honor the choice of an individual to be a donor, to decline to be a donor, and that was in previous law, but it also strengthens the language barring, and that's the word it uses. It bars an individual from overriding somebody's decision regarding donation. It also expands the list. Under the section that says who may make a gift for an individual after death, it expands that to add, it adds an agent, adult grandchildren, and a person who has exhibited special care or concern for the prospective donor. And I apologize, I don't know. That is in Section 9, beginning on the top of page 8. This act also, throughout the act, creates a default rule for the interpretation of a document of gift stating that a gift is used for transplantation and therapy as a priority over research and education. Section 21 allows for the donation to proceed while accommodating end-of-life decisions regarding sustaining of support. So that is an important new addition to this act. This act also recognizes the documents of gifts from other states. That was not in previous law. So in other words, if you have donor on your driver's license, you're a registered donor in Minnesota, and you were to die in Iowa, that document of gift would still be honored. So those are some of the key changes. It also, in Section 23, has a new section related to collaboration between the procurement organizations and the medical examiners. And then I'd just like to add that this act is endorsed by the American Academy of Ophthalmology, the American Association of Tissue Banks, the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery, the Association of Organ Procurement Organizations, Cornea Association, the Eye Bank Association of America, the National Kidney Foundation, the United Network for Organ Sharing, the American Medical Association, and the American Bar Association. It was drafted over a two-year period with extensive input from all of these organizations. And it's our hope that you will choose to adopt this important act.
So, Ms. Larson, the provisions that you've highlighted, that's the new language that's different from what's in current law?
Yeah, that's some of the new provisions that are different from current law. It's a 22-page act, so it's hard to go over specifically which specific language is new versus old. That's why we handed out the side-by-side comparison.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam, could you talk about the repealers? I don't think you... Did you cover the repealers on this bill?
Madam Chair.
No, Senator Shine.
Madam Chair, they are listed at the back. If you would like to, we can certainly.
Is it
just recodification? So there's nothing here that's substantive.
I understand.
Or a change of policy.
Senator Shine.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Why don't we have your witness give her testimony so that when we recess, she can leave. So that when we come back, we can just talk about the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Jean Janahosky. I am donor mom to my son, Alan. Alan is forever 17 years, 1 month, and 4 days old. Alan was always a gentle, caring, considerate boy, always extending love to his family and friends. This quality followed him the rest of his life. One evening while I was preparing dinner, Alan came home from school, actually his driver's education class, spread all his papers across the kitchen table, and asked me if I thought he should check yes for organ donation on his driver's license application. To be honest, I was shocked and unprepared to address the subject, but he persisted. He stated that, Mom, if something happens to me and I can no longer use my organs and they will help someone else, why not? Alan proceeded to check yes on his driver's license. 1 year later, in June of 2002, Alan was visiting family friends in Alabama. After an exciting day of activities, 5 minutes from their home destination, a tragic accident occurred, sending Alan helicopter-bound to a trauma center in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Our family immediately chartered a plane and flew to Chattanooga, finding Alan critical with a head injury. It soon became clear that Alan's life was to be no more. Broken-hearted, Alan's father and myself desperately searched for guidance to somehow extend Alan's time with us. But Alan had already given us that answer, that evening discussion while I was preparing dinner. Alan became a true hero the next day when he gave the gift of life to five people in need of his heart, both kidneys, pancreas, liver, small intestine, and the gift of sight with one of his corneas. Alan's love lives forever in our hearts, and his circle of life continues within the lives of those he saved. In 2004, here in Minneapolis at the U.S. Transplant Games, I had the wonderful opportunity to meet Jimmy, Alan's kidney pancreas recipient from Mississippi. Our families joined together, and at the end of 3 days, we merged as one family. I'm very proud to say Alan's legacy lives on through his gifts of life. His donation has been critical to my family's healing. It gave us strength to endure the yesterdays, courage and hope to live the todays and all the tomorrows. Every member of my family aspires to someday making organ donation our family legacy. Alan was a country western fan, and I always like to quote Travis Tritt in one of his songs, and I believe it's Three Wooden Crosses. And it says, "It's not what you take with you when you leave this world behind. It's what you leave behind you when you go." Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Senator Shides?
Madam Chair, did you... I haven't looked my watch. Did you want to have us go through section by section? Because we can do that, and I can do that. I think Mr. Davies can also highlight again for you if you wish.
I think we can.
Those differences.
We'll consider that when we reconvene the committee. Is there anybody else here in the audience who would like to testify on this bill who might not be able to get back at 6 o'clock? Right. Well, we will recess and we'll reconvene at 6 o'clock.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay.
Members, can you put your things on the bottom of your board to just push it inside?
Put the thing you need to keep inside.
The folder on the inside of the table behind your name.
So that people don't mess with it.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
There's a great new.
Oh.
Oh.